You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 1st of March 2017, Monocle 24. Live from London, this is Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck. On today's show,
I am here tonight to deliver a message of unity and strength, and it is a message deeply delivered from my heart.
Donald Trump swaps an apocalyptic tone for one of optimism in his address to Congress, but was anyone convinced? Meanwhile in France, François Fillon wades into more hot water as a formal investigation is launched into his family's finances. We'll also discuss the politics and baggage involved with the Saudi King's visit to Indonesia. And a little later, a lesson on how not to attract new recruits.
Hey guys, I'm just heading downstairs for my paleo pear and banana bread. Would you like to join me?
No thanks, it's a little bit fancy for me. I'm actually off to an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Stuff Network meeting.
Well, a disastrous publicity campaign aimed at new staff has left one of Australia's government departments with a red face. We'll look at the do's and don'ts of recruitment. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. Well, welcome to the programme. My guests today are Elizabeth Broad, non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, and Tim Marshall, editor of the whatandthewhy.com, and also a foreign affairs analyst. Well, some have called Donald Trump's first major address to Congress a turning point for his presidency. While avoiding his divisive, confrontational style of the past, Trump also spoke of some rather big ticket plans, but offered few details. There was a reassurance of US support for NATO and also calls for a rejection of trivial fights. And the wall is apparently still going to be built. Well, Elizabeth, what did you make of the shift of tone?
I think it was a very cunning strategy because now he all of a sudden seems like a statesman. And a month ago, 2 months ago, if he had started like this, then everybody would have expected him to continue in a statesman-like manner. And now, and they would have been disappointed. But now, all of a sudden, he looks like the epitome of moderation after his rounds now for the past couple of months. So it was very clever. And if I may continue on a slightly different track, he reminded me of Nixon with his madman theory. Those of us who have studied Nixon will remember his madman theory that went something like this. We'll just slip word that Nixon is obsessed about the communists, and that created fear of Nixon and made people think he was irrational and would make irrational decisions. And Trump has been acting in the same way, and now that he seems to be a bit more moderate, it's a huge relief.
Tim, when we listen to this, is this just another part of the unpredictable pattern? You know, he might be back to being his tweeting old self tomorrow.
That's my guess. I mean, he gave us a right hook on the Inauguration Day speech, and everyone's been staggering around ever since then. He's been jabbing away every day with a tweet, staggering around. Well, he's just giving a left hook now. Not to calm us down, to knock us off balance again. He'll be back. It's in his temperament. It was a good speech. I would give it a B+. Now, the reason I'm going to give it a B+ is because he gave himself a C+. 2 hours before he did the State of the Union, he gave an interview to Fox News. And he was asked to score himself, and he said, on my decision-making, A+. On this, A+. On you know, how we're doing, A+. Communication skills, okay, C, maybe C+. He's actually internalized that he's not communicating, and so he came in with this statesman-like thing. Now everybody realizes that it's potential that he can be a grown-up, but he will tweet again at some point.
He did say his messaging hadn't been successful. Do you sense that someone's had a word in his ear, or is it more likely that he's looked at some of the poll results, which say that, you know, on the whole, people remain very disappointed with his presidency?
I think he's had a look at his poll results, and it doesn't seem like he listens to advisors, but he does listen to the people. And so when these ordinary voters who catapulted him from nowhere into the presidency start realizing that they've been had, they won't support him anymore, and that would be the end of him, rather than the departure of various advisors who will invariably have to leave when they embarrass themselves.
Now, one of his big ticket items was that he's going to spend $1 trillion on infrastructure projects. Now, you know, when we look at the US and when we go there, it's a country that, you know, I guess that 30, 40 years ago, you were in awe of its airlines. Mm. You were in awe of your arriving at JFK. It seemed space age, futuristic. You know, it was a step ahead of everywhere else. Most people who travel through the US now kind of can't believe that there isn't a high-speed rail link from JFK into the center of Manhattan, that most airports are terribly run. Is he onto something here?
Absolutely he's onto something. And if he wasn't such an objectional character, the plan would be looked at more seriously, because as far as I can see, it's a very, very good plan. If a Democrat had said, I've got $1 trillion I want to invest, left of center thinking people would say, this is a great idea, because that's what Democrats do. They invest. He's investing. I mean, we've got to get past his orangeness and look at some of the details. A lot of it, for me, doesn't add up. His foreign policy is odd. But this is a very, very good and much-needed plan. You can make an argument for the defense budget that he's going. Where he's going to take the money from the State Department and give it to defense is arguable. But his defense planning shows signs of grown-ups behind it. And as Elizabeth was saying about people being disappointed, the base is not. The base is saying, base support, yep, he's delivering. I actually think so far, in his and their terms, he's having a successful presidency.
Elizabeth, when we talk about infrastructure, there's a really intriguing thing, because traditionally Republicans have been opposed to large amounts of spending triggered by central government. Now, obviously, he is talking about partnerships between central government and also private enterprise. He's obviously going to try and get them to do a lot of the heavy lifting. But Republicans, are they going to be cautious of signing off on these huge checks, which is going to leave the U.S. nation in debt?
I think so. And if I can go back to what we talked about earlier, the state of the infrastructure in the U.S., if you look at the train line between Washington and New York and on to Boston, it's a disgrace. Yeah. And yet it could be a thriving corridor of high-speed trains going back and forth between these extremely important cities where people actually need to travel every day in many cases. I remember, for example, I lived in Washington for 8 years, and once I had the terrible idea of wanting to travel to New York on Amtrak with my son, who was at the time in a buggy. And it was a maddening experience. It was no lift for the buggy, and essentially an exercise of running through back doors and escalators. And imagine if that could be made convenient for all these Americans, highly educated, who travel between Washington, New York, and Boston.
You're right about Amtrak. It's dreadful. Although it has got better, but it's still dreadful. The bridges as well, the intersections, they are crumbling. And it does give you a shock when you used to go to the States and see it as this vibrant, modern place.
We're finding something. We have some common ground here with this Trump. Now, when we come to the question of the wall, do you think he's kind of done himself a disservice there in a way? The wall has been presented in such an emotive and extraordinary way. Would he have been better saying, you know, we want to have a secure border, which is, I guess, what most countries would like to have and like to claim they have? Should he have, if he had started off in a less emotive way about it, would we also be supportive there, do you think, Elizabeth?
I think we would definitely be supportive, and nobody would argue that having a Swiss cheese border is a good thing for a country. Nobody likes to let criminals into their country. But, of course, he made it so outrageous that now we all have to oppose it for ethical reasons. But you're absolutely right. And maybe...
Well, we don't all have to oppose it. There's 60 million Americans that support it.
Well, us liberal Europeans.
You're assuming something here. Okay, I concur with you, and I'm deeply troubled by his rhetoric and the language he uses and his social views. However, under the Obama administration, large sections of fence were built. I can give you quotes from Obama in 2008 about any country must secure its borders. We must stop illegals coming through. Exactly the same words put in the orange man's mouth, people shriek about. I'll give you another quote, because it's in the same ballpark. I'm a better speechwriter than my speechwriters. I'm a better policymaker than my policymakers. I'm going to be a better president than you can possibly imagine. Who do you think said that? Barack Obama, 2008. But if you put those words into the orange man's head, face, mouth, so what, the point I'm making is you've got to get past how much you loathe him and look at policy.
But in the end, Elizabeth, do you think we just have to hold on to the edge of our seats? Because, you know, he was conciliatory yesterday towards undocumented workers, saying that actually many of them would probably become documented through this process. He also spoke out against attacks on Jewish cemeteries. Now, there'd been lots of kind of concern in the past, you know, that he had done very little around acknowledging the Holocaust, you know, coming to the support of Jewish people. There were many weird nuances yesterday that make it just hard for people to pin down where he stands. And is that really the truth? We're just going to have to think of the next 4 years as a little bit of on the edge of your seat, not sure what's going to happen.
Yes, and that's part of the madman theory, right? That you're unpredictable, and that lends you power, because if people can't predict, can't follow a logical train of thought that you will pursue, then they will have to pay more attention to you.
Well, we're going to move on now to France, where centre-right presidential candidate François Fillon is holding on to his leadership campaign despite chances ever looking ever dimmer of him actually winning the presidential race. Because after news that he's now under formal investigation for allegedly creating fake jobs for his family members broke, Fillon told media today that he is the victim of a political assassination. Tim, is he another one of these politicians that just needs to wake up and smell the red wine?
Yes. I mean, I was surprised when I saw him pull out of that thing this morning, and then I watched the hastily assembled press conference at his headquarters. It looked like he was going to say, OK, I'm completely innocent of everything. Nevertheless, for the good of the country, I'm standing down. So I was actually surprised, because it looks so bad for him. I don't see how he can get out of this. 2 days before he has to file his official papers that I am standing as president of France, he has to appear before a magistrate to be investigated. Now, it is not illegal to pay your wife and your children to work for you if you're a French politician. It's actually done quite a lot.
And it was done for many, many years here in the UK as well.
But, you know, the allegation is more that they didn't do any work, something that he absolutely denies. But, and this is one of the problems with, he may even be right about an assassination, political assassination here. He is being taken out, because I can't see him winning the presidency now. But I just think it's gone so far. You know, you can't rule him out standing down at some point in the future, because the French electorate, we're already a bit suspicious of what is a very mainstream right-of-centre candidate in these times when people aren't looking towards the mainstreams and the old and the conventional. And I just don't think he's got a hope now.
Elizabeth, in the current issue of Monocle, we interviewed Emmanuel Macron, and he seems to be somebody who is going to gain from this.
Yes, that's absolutely the case. And if I can just go back to Tim's point, it's almost delusional, I think, for any candidate to run assuming that his life won't be investigated. And this is such a blatant error of judgment that it was likely or even inevitable that somebody would dig it up and make it a big issue. And so, but why not come clean at the start of his campaign? Because now it's he's looking very silly and like somebody who can't, as you say.
But is that because he's, you know, his supporters, you know, the Catholic rural communities that have supported him in the past, they haven't abandoned him. So potentially as he looks out his window at the people who are closest to him, they're still there. What he's losing is the possibility of winning over the country as a whole.
Yes, we have got a three-way race more today than we had 2 months ago.
But do you think that the reason he hasn't stepped down is because he knows that, you know, he's just looking around at his close supporters who are telling him, don't worry, it's going to be fine.
Yeah.
And he hasn't quite read the room well enough yet.
Yes. And of course, I think it's a legitimate question to ask if his voters would ever consider voting for one of the other candidates. And that's probably his reasoning.
There's a personal thing to this as well, Andrew. People often don't look at, well, they do look at people's personalities, but you've got to factor in things like age. The last 20 years, he's been going towards one goal. One day I might be the president of France. And you only get, probably at his age, one shot at it. Because if he's not going to be this time and someone has two terms, That's in Finnish. So he's desperately hanging on to his dream. But we all agree, it's not happening.
You're talking about lots of these politicians being surrounded by financial scandals. But, oddly, the glorious thing about French politics in the past is, you could be Mitterrand, you could be having it away with whoever you wanted. You could, nobody gave a damn whether you had, lovers and a few kind of financial infidelities along the way as well. Do you think this is a generation of politicians that don't realise that the game has changed?
Yes, I think that's absolutely the case.
Or maybe it hasn't. Maybe they're still playing the game.
And I was also thinking of whether something like this would happen in or could happen in Germany. I mean, can you imagine Angela Merkel hiring her husband to work to be paid by her office, constituency office, and doing no work? And instead, of course, he does work, and he's a professor in his own right. But can you imagine? It's just in Germany, such a thing would not happen. And I think probably 20 years ago or during the time of Mitterrand, as you mentioned, it would not have happened.
Your underlying point is correct. These are new times and the tolerance level is lower.
What do you make of Macron?
39, he's got a chance in that he is new and fresh and different.
Is he literally the Blair of French politics?
Well, we're going to find out. 39,
I mean in the nice way.
Some people might think, hang on, do I want to trust the presidency of this great state to a 39-year-old? Or it might be, no, new, fresh, allegedly clean. Yeah, sure, he was a banker. Yeah, sure, he was part of the Hollande failed presidency, but he did leave. He's out there on his own on Marche. I think he's at the moment he's probably the front runner, but I'm still not ruling out a Le Pen victory. Every day there's something else that is in her favour, and I think Fillon standing still in the candidacy is in her favour.
Well, while we stay with the dodgy French, we talk about Marine Le Pen, because she's accused of misusing €300,000. And today MEP said they weren't going to protect her, that she should potentially kind of face the wrath of the law. But the strange thing is, she's Nigel Farage, often the right-wing politicians, populists, when something wrong happens, they kind of say, I don't care, don't blame me. It's, and nothing sticks. It's the same with Mr. Trump in his campaign. We know these awful, we heard him saying what he would like to do to women, and nothing stuck. But if it had been Barack Obama saying it, it would come back to haunt them. Why do you think that is, Elizabeth? That on the right, on the far right, with the politicians, they just don't care.
That's right. And they are allowed not to care, because as a populist politician, you're allowed to be a bit rough around the edges. And that lends you that genuine aura that voters like, even though they might think it's reprehensible that you might want to do what Trump said he wanted to do to that actress. But it's absolutely double standards. If you're a mainstream politician, you have to be very well behaved and be faithful to your wife, at least now, maybe not 30 years ago. Whereas as a populist politician, you get away with more. And it's the same thing with AfD in Germany.
And Tim, the same for you. Why do you think it is we don't really judge politicians equally across the board? It's interesting when you read the right-wing press here, they often hammer kind of people slightly on the left because I think they think they're too moralistic, that they are, that they're a little bit preachy. So they forgive their own a little bit more than, if you're, Jeremy Corbyn and you were seen drinking a nice glass of wine that cost more than £2.99, the right-wing press here would go bonkers thinking that you were, absolutely a kind of a dishonest type of person and not sticking to your morals. Whereas on the right, you can do what you want because, they have given themselves a little bit more license to act in a more irreverent way, perhaps.
I think it's exactly as you put it. I mean, everyone loathes champagne socialists because they're preaching, and yet, hang on a minute, they're not acting the way that they're doing as they want, and they expect everyone else to behave somewhat differently. Whereas the right can be a little bit more relaxed about these indiscretions and doesn't preach quite as sort of moral upstanding. I mean, they do in other areas. And they are given an easier ride. People absolutely hate hypocrites. And Fillon, who has always said, I am totally clean, if you believe the allegations against him, which he denies, is seen to be a hypocrite. And he's only a centrist. but he's of the centre right. But I think you're right. So the overall thing that you said earlier, the left, people don't like seeing them do things that they preach against. The right wing don't preach morally quite as much, and so sometimes get an easier ride.
Don't worry, we'll talk about football. But the example of Gary Lineker, the very popular British football player.
English. He never played for Scotland.
TV presenter, sells crisps on TV as well. So it strikes me that the right-wing press hate him for his support for Syrian refugees and the refugee...
Yes, he's not only supporting Syrian refugees, he's filthy rich.
Yes, yeah, and also the comeback at him all the time is... But he doesn't have a Syrian refugee living in his house, which is always it's taken to such extreme with anybody on the left that they can't even support something. They have to be acting on it, and they have to be, you know, they want you to be really on the point all the time.
Yeah, well, any stick will do with which to beat your opponent.
Well, we're going to move on now, because you're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, Tim Marshall and Elizabeth Brough. Still to come, a lesson how not to recruit new staff. But up next, Saudi Arabia's king is in Indonesia, and along with diplomacy, he's also brought an awful lot of cars.
It's Monocle's 10th anniversary, and we're kicking off the celebrations with a gathering at the Hyatt Regency London, the Churchill, to talk about all the good things that our corner of the media market has to offer. For our first Monocle Media Summit, we're inviting an international group of distinguished figures, including Francesco Franchi, legendary designer from La Repubblica, James Daunt, fresh from turning around Waterstones, Alec Russell, editor of the thriving FT Weekend, and Christoph Armand, editor of Zeit magazine, to address the state of the industry and offer some powerful stories about everything that's going right on the printed page, over the airwaves, on screen, and in store. Join us on the afternoon and evening of the 2nd of March for some lively discussion, good drinks, and an inspiring intelligence briefing on the future of media. Tyler Brulet, Andrew Tuck, and Robert Bound look forward to welcoming you and to raising a glass or two in thanks to 10 years of your support. Get your tickets now at monocle.com/shop. See you there.
This is Midori House live from London. I'm Andrew Tuck, and still with me are Elizabeth Brough and Tim Marshall. The King of Saudi Arabia is visiting Indonesia for the first time in 47 years as part of a trip aimed at boosting diplomacy and trade. Indonesia expects to see about $25 billion worth of investment during the visit as the Saudis look to diversify their economy away from an over-reliance on oil and gas. However, some fear that the Saudi government is also aiming to increase its influence across other Muslim nations. Elizabeth, what do we make of this visit? So it's not particularly him that hasn't been, it's the first time a Saudi king hasn't been there for 47 years. Why are they suddenly engaging with Southeast Asia and the Muslim nations there in this way?
Well, it seems like they have discovered that there are pilgrims to be had, and Indonesia is a very large Muslim country, and has great potential to send more pilgrims to Mecca. But what struck me about this visit is that the king is very much like most international tourists these days who travel to a country of their choice and then don't interact with the local population. They just interact with people like them. And I saw here he's bringing 620 people with him. So you sort of wonder how much he will get to see of Indonesia and how much he is planning to interact with actual Indonesians.
Tim, isn't you're very good at telling us about the push between Sunni and Shia and the recruitment on both sides. Is that part of that campaign, or is this more just as Elizabeth says, getting enough people to come on the Hajj?
I don't think it's about that. I think this is economics. Look, that is a side issue, and it's an added benefit, and Indonesia is the most populous Muslim country in the world. And yes, great, there's a great stream of revenue the more pilgrims you get, not just on the Hajj, but on the other pilgrimages, which were almost year-round. So that's a bonus. But it is dwarfed by the economics of it. He's going on to China. They export $55 billion a year of goods to China. $55 billion. Now, the European economies have not been growing. The American economy has not been growing. They are trying to diversify, as you said, and that's what it's about. That's why they're really going. It's to make massive, massive trade deals. The Hajj and others is an added benefit. And this is my favourite story of the day, A, because I think it's geopolitically, it's quite a major move. I mean, he's going to Japan, China, Malaysia, and Indonesia.
And the Maldives.
And the Maldives, don't forget that. But the most interesting thing is that it's actually, if you include the delegates and the business people that are going with him, there's 1,500 people in the entourage. 27 flights are required to move the Saudi delegation out of Saudi Arabia and into Indonesia. 27 flights.
Now, when you look at the leaders of Indonesia, they're more humble than...
Very.
And is this likely to play well, do you think?
President Joko is actually quite popular at the moment in Indonesia. I think it'll play well. I think that, you know, Indonesia needs this market. They are on a roll, the Saudis. I mean, the oil price is killing them. We know this. This is why they're really out here. Because the oil price is killing them. They've got to get back out into the world and start selling Saudi Arabia. And this trip looks to be, at the moment, like it's going to do that.
Elizabeth.
Yes, if I can come in on China, yes, which you mentioned earlier. That's a major, major trade link, too, because China is growing its arms industry at a very fast rate. And it's Chinese arms are not as good as European and American weapons, for the time being, but they are getting better. And Saudi Arabia is a major, major destination for weapons. So if China can get a foot in the door and increase its exports to Saudi Arabia, it will be a major development.
Well, finally tonight, a lesson on how not to attract the eager young workers of tomorrow.
Hey guys, I'm just heading downstairs to my paleo pear and banana bread. Would you like to join me?
No, thanks. It's a little bit fancy for me. I'm actually off to an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Stuff Network meeting.
Okay, then, see you. So how are you finding the program?
It's pretty great, to be honest. I've been here less than a year and I never thought that I'd be working on a project supporting the modernisation program across government.
Awesome. I'm working on a project in property and construction. Hey, are you going for the Young Leaders Network dinner tonight?
Yeah, wouldn't miss it. The last one was great.
Oh dear. Well, that's part of a new video produced by the Australian Department of Finance aimed at promoting the agency's culture and attracting new staff. As you might have guessed, the reaction hasn't been so good. One marketing expert told the ABC that it was the worst government video he'd ever seen. While Dee Madigan, from the agency Campaign Edge, said it reinforced every bad notion we've ever heard about the public service. Tim, how awful is it? I kind of cringe because I think these are, I presume, all poor members of staff who've been encouraged to do this and think they've got some acting skills, and they haven't.
It starts off fine for about 10 seconds, then it just falls off a cliff the moment they open their mouths. Oh, hi, I'm really excited about this great planning thing I'm going to do to make everyone's lives better. Would you like to join? And it's just...
Well, you just said it better than they did.
Well, it's awful. The scripting is beyond belief. The acting is incredibly wooden. The whole thing's put together in an awful, awful, cliched way. It is almost a parody. You know, if you were making a parody of how not to make an ad, this would be it. It is the worst thing I have ever seen of its kind. I just, you know, I hope, was it the ad agency or were they given the brief to make it as bad as that? It is how not to attract bright young people into what are actually very good jobs.
Because Elizabeth, this is, you know, these are serious jobs, but I guess they're trying to appeal to a young generation of people who can kind of go and work anyway, in a kind of buoyant economy. Yeah, maybe they're going to a tech business. They're trying to appeal a little bit kind of hip and cool. And that's what makes it even worse, isn't it?
That's right, because they seem so wooden. And in fact, my 10-year-old's class could perform a better school play than this. I mean, they would outperform these actors, whoever they are. Are they actual employees? But I think what it speaks to, this recruitment ad, is the disdain for ordinary people. How about just interviewing actual employees of the ministry?
And Andrew, very briefly, can you imagine? That was actually shown in a screening room somewhere with executives who all looked at it and went, yeah, that'll do.
Oh no, it's terrible. Anyway, do go and have a look though, because it's quite funny.
Oh, it's hilarious.
But that's all we have time for on today's programme. Thanks to our guests, Elizabeth Brohr and Tim Marshall. Midori House was produced by Ben Ryland. It was researched by Fernando Agosto Pacheco and Tom Furs. And our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. More music next, then at 1900 hours, it's The Entrepreneurs. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow.
That's 1800 hours London time, of course. But from me, Andrew Tuck, thank you for listening and goodbye.